From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Outer Mission.
I live in the Nastro.
I live in the Mistro.
La Playa.
I live in the Transmission.
Haight-Ashbury.
I'm in the sunny but filthy Mission.
Coming up, we'll hear why Bay Area gamers are still devoted to a 22-year-old fantasy card game.
This one I'm working on now is called Obnixilis. The best way I can describe them, I would say Iron Maiden meets demonic possession.
And we'll understand why this game is way more than just a fad.
It's supposed to be a fun game that you play with your friends, a cheap, fun game. But all of a sudden, there were these rare, powerful cards that you could buy if you had enough money that would allow you to beat your friends senseless.
It's a magic show, and you won't believe your ears today on Cross Currents. Today, we're talking about magic. No, not that type of magic. This kind of magic.
Here is both his guys. The strive of Johnny's presence.
This is sound from the end of the 2015 Magic the Gathering Professional World Championships.
Sure, says Flock. He's looking. Here it comes.
Magic the Gathering is a collectible fantasy card game. It's been around since the 1990s, and it's still thriving. The game has over 20 million fans. It's a $200 million a year industry. And there are some cards that are worth more than the monthly rent for a two-bedroom apartment in San Francisco.
And you are going to see even Flock of the Slovak Republic. You've never seen anyone play a turn so fast. In they come. It's the angels and the sheep for Even Flock, who wins the Pro Tour.
Holy sheep.
That was unreal.
But the game had humble beginnings. It started off as a geeky pastime, an update of Dungeons & Dragons. Remember that? Quaint and a little cheesy, just like this promo from 1995.
Come now, just a little farther. The portal to Dominia is right over there.
But since then, it's become a slick powerhouse.
A world that needs you. Ruled by Khan.
20th Century Fox recently acquired the rights to start a film franchise, and this winter, Magic passed an essential cultural milestone. There was a full episode of South Park lampooning the game.
At one point, Kenny actually polymorphed the dude into a blue frog with an instant attack card. It was carnage, bro!
So how has a 90s game managed to retain its popularity in the smartphone era? KALW's Jeremy Dalmas visited one of the annual local tournaments to check out what makes these cards so resilient.
Suddenly, the peace is broken.
Mountain?
Planeswalker Mike Escalante is amassing his army.
Is that a surfing goblin?
Yeah.
But Planeswalker Matt Wilcox is unfazed. He summons a demon.
This one's called Archfiend of Depravity.
Escalante's reinforcements arrive on horseback just in time.
Warflare?
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
And Wilcox admits defeat.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you just lose?
Yes, I did just lose.
Welcome to Magic the Gathering. You are a planeswalker, a wizard who, well, you're actually just a gamer. A gamer who can summon legendary beasts. I mean, collect limited edition cards, build them into decks, and battle opponents. You start the game with 20 life points, and with a hand filled with creature cards and spell cards. You and your opponents take turns using those cards to cast spells against one another, to summon creatures to attack, and to prevent your life points from hitting zero. That's the basics. And the true test of a planeswalker is at one of the traveling tournaments, which, this year, was at the battlegrounds of the San Jose Convention Center.
We have 1,965 players here today. Thank you for coming out and making this a gigantic event.
Welcome to Grand Prix San Jose. Magic tournaments like this one used to be cozy. Look down the convention hall today and you see hundreds of tables. And every year, there are more. Matt Wilcox may have lost that earlier game, but at this tournament, he has another chance. He's with teammates Michelle Robertson and Mike Kahn. What do these warriors hope to accomplish today?
If we could win 6 of our 9 rounds, I'd be pretty happy.
Well, I guess that's our goal, right?
They get their cards and start amassing clans of horseback warriors and mystical monks. Walk around the tournament and you'll see how dedicated people are to these cards. There's Christine Sprankle, who is dressed up as the character Gisa, a ghoul caller from the game who raises the undead.
I look like a demented bride. It's my wedding attire, and every night's my wedding with my ghouls, so that's my weekend.
There are judges like Toby Elliott who travel from tournament to tournament like fans for a band might.
And I've grown up with a lot of these people and spent a lot of time with them, and they're some of my dearest friends. These are our times to get together.
And there are artists here who sign cards the same way authors sign books. Right now, Jason Felix is drawing one of his characters for a fan.
This one I'm working on now is called Obnixilis. The best way I can describe him, Kiss meets Iron Maiden meets, demonic possession.
I get a text. The team is at table 917. My visions of them as victorious warriors are dashed when I find out they lost their first round.
All right, this is the start of round 2. You have 50 minutes. You may begin.
The edge of the room is lined with a dozen vendors, each with hundreds of their best cards under plexiglass. Magic isn't just for playing. Collecting is huge. Harrison Bates works for one of those vendors.
Yeah, we came from LA.
Good cards can sell anywhere from under a buck to, well, the most expensive card I saw was one called Black Lotus, with a $5,400 price tag.
That's a lot of money in Magic, yeah, hell yeah.
You can buy a pack of 15 random new cards for about $3 or $4. Wizards of the Coast, the company that makes the game, only prints so many of each card, and the most powerful cards are often the rarest, meaning you have to buy lots of packs to find the cards you want, or you have to purchase those cards off of someone else who bought those packs. Bates is trying to find foil cards, shiny versions of normal cards.
I've been foiling out all weekend because I love the deck so much, you know, so I feel like the deck should feel that I love it.
In tournaments like this one, you can only use the newest cards, meaning you keep buying. There is no denying that this is an expensive hobby, and Wizards of the Coast has thought hard about how to keep players buying new cards year after year. I get a text. The team is at table 505. One of our heroes, Matt Wilcox, is battling Phil Takata, a biology teacher who brought students to the tournament. Wilcox has summoned a phoenix. But it's no match for Takata's dragon.
Oh, no.
Big dragon.
Yeah, that's good.
Go, dragon!
Good game.
Matt, it was a pleasure.
Our warriors aren't doing that well.
We are currently at 1 win and 3 losses. Not as great as we had hoped, but at least we're not winless.
Meaning, to achieve their goal, they can't lose any more games. But, of course, this isn't just about winning. Teammate Michelle Robertson explains.
I moved out here from Florida last year, and this is a great way to make friends with people who love the same things you do. I've met other women who are really into the game, and you don't see a lot of women at Magic tournaments, so it's really cool.
They rush off to the next battle.
Sealed Challenge players, your pairings are being posted. Please find your seats.
Look around the room, and it's hard to miss that probably 90% of the people competing are young men.
It's no secret to Wizards of the Coast. Tom LaPelli used to work there, and he says that the best way to have more diverse players is to have the cards be representative. Recently, they introduced
the first transgender character in the Magic world. It was just incredibly supportive, and that's not a given in the gaming world, right? Like, it's not always as that accepting of a place to be.
More casual play isn't as much of an issue, but it can be hard to make tournaments welcoming for women. One woman I asked at the tournament didn't want to be recorded on tape talking about it because she was afraid of backlash from the greater gaming community. But there are more women coming to tournaments than used to, even if that number is small. I head over to the team. They've lost 4 games, and they look a little glum.
We're out of contention for any sort of prize. We got here at like 9 o'clock in the morning, and it's about to be 8 o'clock?
I'm tired. You can probably tell my voice is kind of gone. I personally let my team down more than they let me down.
Even though we were not successful in our Magic domination, we still had a really great time. We met a lot of cool people.
Our heroes pack their cards into their bags, hang their heads, and head back home. Even the bravest warriors must sometimes admit defeat. For Cross Currents, I'm Jeremy Dalmas.
Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. So we just got a first-hand look at a Magic the Gathering tournament in San Jose, and we heard how some special cards are so rare, their resale value can reach thousands of dollars. Now, in order to understand why a tiny piece of cardboard can end up costing so much, you need to know a thing or two about economic bubbles. We hear that word here in the Bay Area a lot. The housing bubble, the tech bubble, dot-com bubbles. But bubbles also happen in the world of toys. Remember Beanie Babies or Pogs or Cabbage Patch Dolls?
Just a simple fad. Then someone figures out they can make money by reselling that thing.
That's Robert Smith from NPR's Planet Money podcast. They recently aired an episode on the economics behind Magic the Gathering. The game, he says, started out as a fad. Everyone wanted the cards. They had to have them. It's the first stage of a bubble. But then people started selling them.
Stage 2 of the bubble. No matter how much you pay, there is some chump willing to pay more.
Take, for example, Beanie Babies. You put your Beanie Babies up on eBay, you make money, you start buying more and selling more, and then...
You know how this story ends, the way all bubbles end. Stage 3, too many Beanie Babies. The market crashed.
But the story of Magic the Gathering, it didn't end. The bubble never burst because the creators figured out a way to make sure it didn't. Here's Planet Money's Robert Smith with the rest of the story.
Now, I have to admit something. I do not know a lot about the card game Magic. I was vaguely aware of it back in the 1990s. I was just starting in radio, and our studios were actually right above a card store that specialized in selling these Magic cards. And when you went down there, the place was very Dungeons and Dragons, lots of teenagers hanging out, but it was definitely this big fad. And NPR back at the time gave it the full serious treatment.
Americans by the millions are discovering a new card game. It's called Magic the Gathering. It's one of the fastest growing games in the country. Magic is played with elaborately illustrated cards and a complicated set of rules.
Now, I had assumed that this whole fad completely disappeared because I hadn't heard anything about it recently. But then one of our producers here in the office, Kwok Tuong Bui, said to me,
"This game is alive and kicking. There's so many people that play this game. I am a huge fan myself. I'm actually going to play it this Sunday. Me and a group of friends of mine, we're going to go out to a bar and we're going to play."
So Bui explained to me that basically these cards are like baseball cards. He's translating it for an old man like myself. And they have these creatures on them and basically statistics about how powerful they are. But unlike baseball cards, you can actually do something with them. You can actually play a game.
Yeah, it's kind of actually really funny. You're like a wizard, and each one of these cards is a spell in your deck. And the trick to this game is that you have to assemble enough spells in the right combination so that you can beat your opponent.
It is supremely nerdy, and I mean that in the best possible way. It was designed by math graduate students for people who eventually might be math graduate students. We tracked down one of the early employees of Magic, a math and physics grad student named Scaff Elias, and he says from the beginning, they suspected that these cards would be addictive.
Every game you played was different. You know, you immediately thought about, wow, if I could change my deck, if I could take this out or I could put that in, it would play a different way strategically.
But there was one hook to this game that would come back to bite them, and this is the economics part. They sold the cards in packs. You'd pay like $3 for a pack and get a bunch of random cards. But occasionally, there would be a rare and powerful something in there, a dragon, an angel. It was like a little lottery ticket.
So that anticipation of, did I get the best one of those 100 rare cards is, yeah, that's a super exciting for people.
And Scaff's right. You know, you go to the store, you buy pack after pack after pack looking for that rare card.
And they expected this when they started the game. But what they didn't quite plan for was that once people got those rare cards, they would start to resell them for a lot of money. The rare dragons and creatures and even rare flowers started to go for more and more money.
Some of these cards that nominally are $3 a piece because they're the one rare card that comes in a $3 pack, eventually those become $10 cards and $15 cards and then $100 cards and then $500 cards. And this all happened in the first year.
This should start to sound familiar. This is a stage two bubble. And from a business perspective, it was a gold mine. I mean, the company that owned the Magic cards, which is a company called Wizards of the Coast, was literally selling pieces of paper that some people thought were worth a fortune. Speculators would buy cards by the ton, trying to find these rare cards.
People at the company, a lot of them wanted to push that side of it. Produce more cards, produce rarer cards, keep the print runs limited.
For many people, the symbol of this craze was something called the Black Lotus.
The Black Lotus.
Now you gotta say, like, the Black Lotus.
It wasn't a monster. It's not a dragon. It's just a flower. But it gave you the special ability. It let you have extra power sooner than anyone else, which meant that if you had enough of these, you could beat your opponent really fast.
And this card ended up being worth what?
It was worth thousands of dollars.
And to show you how exciting this card was, we're going to play you a YouTube video going around of a man who was opening up a pack of random Magic cards. He's flipping through them, and he finds a Black Lotus.
And then the other one is, holy boosh! That's a freaking Black Lotus! Holy God! Oh my God! Oh my gosh! Where's my sleeve? I did it! Holy mackerel, it's right there!
Magic was well on its way to being the next Beanie Baby. But Scaff and his fellow designers saw a big problem here. Because remember, Magic isn't just a collectible thing like a Beanie Baby you put on your shelf. It's also supposed to be a game. It's supposed to be a fun game that you play with your friends, a cheap, fun game. But all of a sudden, there were these rare, powerful cards that you could buy if you had enough money that would allow you to beat your friends senseless.
You know, at first, it doesn't sound so bad, right? But imagine you're playing a high-stakes poker game, and you could go to the store and buy just 10 aces. Nobody would play poker.
Nobody would play that game. This is what the Magic folks were worried about. Scaff and some of the other math guys looked around and said, you know, this bubble is going to pop hard. This is going to be like Cabbage Patch Kids or Star Wars figurines or Pogs. Now, being a math guy and working with other math guys, they actually went out and graphed the life cycle of a fad. They used research into comic books and baseball cards to figure out how much time they might have.
The stuff we looked at had its height, like where it was sort of white hot would be around a 2-year time span. At some point you realize, well, I just spent $1,000 and there's only $25 worth of comics here that I actually want to read. And that hits you like a ton of bricks. And as soon as enough people believe that the momentum in the market changes, and then there's a big problem.
Scaff and his friends made an argument to the rest of the company. Sure, you could make a lot of cash in 2 years. You could burn this whole thing out and walk away with millions of dollars. But he said, perhaps we should see if we can make Magic sustainable. If we can make less money in the short term, but keep it going for 5 years or 10 years. Perhaps, he said, we can deflate this bubble without popping it.
So the first thing they had to do was bring back the price of Magic cards to a normal level so that an average person could buy them again. So they fired up the printing presses and basically printed a slew of new cards.
We just printed so many cards of the new sets coming out. We warned people that we were going to do that. But what that meant immediately from the get-go was even though people could still make money on the secondary market of the older cards, the speculators would no longer touch a new set of cards coming out.
And they had a pretty neat trick to doing this. They would basically print a bunch of cards. Then they would go out to the card shops to see what the packs were selling for. And if they were selling for more than retail price, they would print some more and some more and some more. And eventually, even the most stubborn speculators gave out. They were able to push the price of each pack down to what they really wanted to sell them at, about $3. The collectors were not pleased.
We heard from so many people that we were destroying the game back in 1994 and in 95 over and over again. Like, this is the end. You guys have screwed everything up with much more colorful language.
And they had just started. Because they had a second problem, all those old cards. Remember the Black Lotus, the rare dragons? They were so powerful that you couldn't just print a lot of those because that would still ruin the game. And they were worried about pissing off fans even more than they already were. You imagine this kid who saved his allowance for a year just to get a rare card. They didn't want to say like, ha ha ha, it's worth nothing now.
So they came up with another solution. They tried to ban the cards from play.
And that didn't work.
That didn't work at all because players wanted to play the way they learned how to play. They came up with a really interesting fix. They created the Pro League.
A professional Magic card league.
Yeah.
The crowd is
into
it.
Come on, deck.
What is on top of the deck? What is on top of the deck? Oh, it's Lightning Helix! Oh, my God! Oh, my God!
It may be hard to believe, but there are actual audiences who will come and watch the very best Magic card players play against each other. And the Pro League had an advantage for the company that made Magic because the company that made Magic could set the rules for the Pro League.
Yeah, that's right. So they set a rule that said you could only play with the most recent set of cards. No Black Lotuses, no super powerful monster cards, just the last 2 years.
And so by setting those rules, they basically say to players everywhere, sure, you could use the old cards, but if you want to, you know, do what the pros do, you should only use the new cards.
That's right. And the plan worked.
Essentially, they figured out how to keep the economy of the game stable. And talking to people involved in the game, it's amazing how much they talk as if they are sort of a central bank running an economy. They want stable prices. They want the game to grow, but they don't want to grow too fast and they don't want to grow too slow. There's this target for growth. They managed to make a game that, what is it now, Bowie, 22 years later?
Yeah, 22 years strong.
22 years, Bowie is still going to play it this weekend. And in fact, he dragged me down to a card store the other night, Friday night at midnight, where people were lined up to get the latest set of cards.
If you are not signed up and paid for in advance, please wait to the back of the line and we will take care of you at the end. All right, who's excited for Fate Reforged?
And Bowie, I had no idea this existed. First of all, that there was a store like this called the 20-sided store after the dice, but that people were basically going to play this new set of cards all night long. How many people were there?
There were at least 50 people there. They were all lined up to play this new deck of cards before anybody else.
And they were packed in. They're like ripping open these packs and like slapping down their cards and shuffling them. And you can see how the company sort of has nailed this line between the sort of rare collectibles and this game that keeps playing, because there was actually a rare card on the deck. It was called
The Ugin. It kind of looked like a blue dragon kind of floating in space.
Nobody could really explain to me what the Ugin did, but you could tell when somebody in the crowd opened their pack and pulled one out.
Oh, that's sick! We got an Ugin!
Who got an Ugin?
We got an Ugin!
Yeah, I got an Ugin.
An Ugin, is that cool?
It's pretty cool.
It is the best card in the set.
It's like $30 right now.
All right. Are you going to sell it?
Maybe.
Not this second.
Not this second. For now, I'm playing with it.
This moment right here is exactly what the makers of Magic cards want to hear. This guy just got a rare card. He was super excited, but rather than put it in a plastic case or a frame, rather than run to a dealer and try and sell it, he decides he's going to play with it. He decides he's going to go with the game.
Thanks to Robert Smith and the Planet Money team for letting us use that story. Also thanks to producer Jess Jang and Corbin Horsler, Lauren Blanco, Ben Blyweiss, Jim Brusso, and WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky for help with that piece. So, if you liked it, find a link to the Planet Money podcast at klw.org. Click Cross Currents. And that's our magic show. Cross Currents team includes Leela Godsire Day, Jack Megalanoff Detch, Audrey Progenitus Dilling, Sandhya Stoic Angel Dirks, Rachel Apocalypse Hydra Dornhelm, Nina Gensler Black Lotus Debs, Chris Slag Fiend Hoff, Marcy Primeval Bounty Fraser, Ted Dragon Brood Mother Muldoon, and Stephen Koff of the Hammer Short. The show was engineered by Seth, Demon of Death's Gate, Samuel, and the line producer was Angela Raktos, Lord of Riots, Johnston. Our managing editor is Jen the Skybreaker Chien. Our managing producer is Julie Inferno Titan Kane. Ben Vraska the Unseen Trefney is our news director. And our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And this music is by San Francisco band Fosser House. They'll be playing at the Parkside in San Francisco on Friday night. Music starts at 9 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.